Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Angela Hood of This Way Global coming to us here in San Francisco from Austin, Texas. But where are we, Angela?
We are at TechCrunch Disrupt San Francisco. It's very cool.
Very cool. These guys had a booth here yesterday. Yep. So how's that been going?
Well, we've recovered. We were exhausted. Mm-hmm. But it was really great traction. We had a lot of more corporations than we actually expected. We had some really good investor interactions as well. But our focus was on revenue. And so that's, you know, we were very excited about some of the customers we talked to yesterday.
So you think it's going to be a positive ROI on the flights and booths?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. So we target 5 times our expenses when we come to something, and I think we'll clear that.
So we're going to get into your business and fundraising because that's the show about. But any tips for people who come to these events, how to get that 5x ROI? I think that's, elusive in many cases.
Yeah, it is.
We've only done that for Foundersuite, I think, 2 events that we've actually made a profit on.
Really? Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, so. It is hard. I think part of it is making sure you bring the right team.
Mm-hmm.
I brought people that were actually part of our team. We didn't hire people to come and just stand in the booth, because that way everyone in the booth actually has a stake in what's happening. And I think that we have better interaction when people walk up to us and they actually, it's more meaningful than just like, here's my card, and then, you know, email someone about it.
Right.
It just doesn't work the same way. Because they're coming here to kind of see what you're about and what is your passion about what you're doing.
Sure.
That resonates no matter the size company or the size investment house that you're talking to.
Yeah.
And then I think the other part is just really budgeting. Is like saying, okay, we're going to spend this much money. What are we going to do? And who do we need to talk to? How many deals do we need to close by what time? And sort of set those metrics and then hold everyone accountable on a regular basis for that.
And then last question, we'll get to the core of the show. How much prep work did you do setting up meetings in advance of Disrupt versus just organic people walking by your booth, grabbing their card?
Honestly, we did everything organic. We made sure that we had a sign that was very simple. We took the billboard approach, right? So no more than 7 words. On the sign.
Oh, good.
And we find that qualifies people for us, so we're not wasting time with people that, you know, we have no business talking to.
Yeah.
And I would rather close 2 or 3 really significant deals than have 50 that are kind of half-hearted.
Yeah.
And that the signage helped a lot. And then we had t-shirts we were going to be able to give away, and no one really wanted to have to haul them around.
Sure.
So then people were like, hey, can you mail t-shirts to us? We're like, no, we're not going to mail t-shirts.
No.
So, but that's what we did, and it worked out really good for us.
Awesome. All right. Let's get into what you do.
So we have a product called AI for Jobs, and it's artificial intelligence for jobs. But very simply, we match people to jobs at certain companies. And we triangulate the data between those 3 things, the company, the job, and the person, rather than matching a resume to a job description.
Mm.
And that's where things go really haywire. We kind of function 2 ways. We can sit on the back of an applicant tracking system, or we have our own interface, so a customer can just use it directly. And recruiters love it because instead of spending somewhere between 17 and 38 hours to try to source for 1 job, they can source, it starts off between 2 and 3 minutes, and then over time it gets down to 3 or 4 seconds.
Mm.
So the savings for them is they're getting to a short list of qualified candidates very quickly and not having to spend the time looking through thousands and thousands of unqualified resumes.
And so your customers are actually the companies hiring, not a job site like Indeed or something like that.
Correct. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we work directly with employers. Mm-hmm. We also have staffing agencies, recruiters, things like that. They're our customers.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily, it doesn't really matter the type of job it is. It could be blue collar, white collar. That part doesn't matter. It doesn't matter the location. What really matters is that it's companies that really care about hiring the right people. That's a big focus for them. Or they have a huge hiring push. So seasonal hiring, something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
It works for contingent, it works for full full-time, part-time. That also, that part doesn't matter either. We worked really hard to make sure that it could work across the entire playing field, because otherwise customers were like, well, I don't want to just use one tool for part of my workforce. I want to be able to use one platform that does all of that.
Awesome. Cool. Very interesting. And where did this come from? What's the quick backstory?
Yeah, so it's kind of a variety of things, but I am a military spouse. And we have a weird career, because you work for a company for 2 years and then you have to move because you know, you're a military family and you're on the move. Same thing happens for your children, because so even if they're trying to get a first job, you know, they're kind of moving around a lot. And then also too, is a military family, you've got a veteran that eventually transitions out of active duty service and into the civilian world, and that transition is oftentimes really, really difficult. So just having that experience made me think that we were unusual as a family. And then when I started researching a bit, I found out that we were not that unusual. That is actually something that everyone struggles with. And it has a lot to do with unconscious biases that happen and also technology that just underperforms what it really should do. And so I went to IdeaSpace at University of Cambridge in England, and I said, will you help me? And this is the problem I want to solve. They tasked their founders with changing the world in a positive way in 3 to 5 years. So it's not an easy thing to do, but I took it seriously, negotiated some really good deals with 7 different countries, and we built some internship programs that were highly effective. And now we've launched AI for Jobs, and it has been really well received. We're very excited about it. And yesterday was a real proof point for us at the type of companies that were coming to us.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. All right. Let's talk about fundraising. So how much have you guys raised, and what?
So we put our own money in first. I felt pretty strongly about that, because I felt like that indicates to my team and to future investors my level of commitment. So we did that. I sold my Ford Mustang, my 1967 convertible. To Seed. That was painful, but it also demonstrated to myself that I was truly committed. I'll buy a Shelby one day. So that's how I think of it.
Right.
And then we did a small friend and family.
Sorry to interrupt you. That's what I love, is founders need to understand these stories.
Yeah.
Like, it takes selling your 67 Mustang to get your startup off the ground in many cases. So,
It does. I mean, and it took, it was really tough. I mean, it sounds maybe ridiculous if you've never had a classic car you loved, but I was, you know, I really love that car, but I thought if I'm not willing to do that, then I actually don't really think I'm going to be able to execute on this. And so it was sort of like my own gut to go, do you mean it? And so, when I went to my husband, who had given that to me for my for a birthday present, and I was like, I want to sell my car, and this is why. And fortunately, he's very supportive. So,
what'd you get for it?
I got 15.5.
Okay. Nice. All right. So then, all right, you take the Mustang money. What's next?
Right. So then, we got some friends and family money that came in. And one of the mistakes I made with this is we kind of allowed some people to invest too low a threshold. So too small of an amount of money. And if I could go back, I wouldn't do it that way again. I would have set the threshold higher. But we were able to work around it. We did that on a convertible note. And so that worked towards us figuring out how our valuation would be later. It was fair to them and fair to the company. So we decided not to do a safe, because it just didn't seem to work for us. So went convertible. And then we raised with 3 super angels, we raised $1 million. Well, a little bit less than $1 million. And that got us to the point where we could actually demonstrate an interface where people could actually see that our technology worked. Because we could prove it worked if we had enough time with a customer, but they wanted to see that it worked in, you know, less than 3 minutes. And so my engineer, he created an interface. Fortunately, he's from Walt Disney, so he was able to, you know, gin something up pretty fast that worked. And we started showing it to people, and literally mind blown. Like, jaws would drop, and these were with some of the biggest companies in the world. And so then that was the point where we were like, okay, now we know this is actually working.
So before, in raising that little under $1 million, though, you didn't have a real great working proof of concept. So you're pitching mostly the idea, the concept. Is that right?
We had, what? Well, we could show, if you could look at code, we could show it to you. And so one of our investors brought in someone that had the ability to do very technical due diligence, looked at what the code actually said, and they're like, yeah, that's real. That's not vaporware. Mm-hmm. And so then we were able to put a front face on it with the funding.
Yeah. And the Super Angels, are you, can you name them, or are they...
I'll tell you where they're out of. So they're out of CTAN, which is the Central Texas Angel Network out of Austin. It's one of the largest angel networks in the U.S.
Central Texas Angel Network.
Yeah.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. CTAN. And they're all board members.
Okay.
And so they're very sophisticated. They're actually full-time investors.
Is that in Austin? Is CTAN in Austin?
Yep, okay. It is. And so they had made... investments that are in a little bit in the space as far as SaaS, but I don't know if any of them had ever made an AI investment at that point. I don't think so. So from that perspective, it was new, but they were not new to the world of investment. One thing I'll say, I can highly recommend Cooley Law Firm, right? Mm. So we went to Cooley, Nick, in Los Angeles, and we got him to help us draft our documents. We did it in a convertible note as well, with a cap. I know that a lot of startups, they want to not put caps on things for their valuation, and I would just say don't do that.
Okay.
It puts too much risk on the investor, and so they won't tell you.
Yeah.
They just will ignore you. So put a good cap on it, and it was fair, and drew up some really good docs, and were able to close the round in just a few weeks.
So how did you get in front of these super angels? Is CTAN something that you apply on the website and you come in and pitch to a dinner audience or something?
Okay, so there is that way.
Then there's Angela's way.
That's not what happened for us. So what happened was we went to college with someone that had a friend that knew someone that led us to one of our first investors. And he's on the board at CTAN. And so we met him, had a great, really got along really well. And he's like, hey, I want to bring someone else in to kind of vet you and to hear what they have to say. We went through that meeting. And then they said, hey, the last person that we want to bring in is a person that we co-invest with. We all get along well.
Yeah.
And we said, okay, sounds good. So we closed the deal with them. And then we extended the round, which I had not planned on doing. I had not planned on oversubscribing.
Yep.
But we had really good investors that wanted to come on board. And it was just such a good opportunity for us to have that kind of key connection with them. And then we also had a friend and family investor that wanted to put more money in. So we did that. We actually, as individuals, put more money in as the founders.
Uh-huh.
And, then we were off to the races, and we started showing the product to enterprise.
Okay, great. So those three board members of CTAN are the main investors, and you had a few others kind of pick up a few chunks.
Right.
Any more details on raising from an angel group? I mean, that's something we actually haven't covered on this show too much. It sounds like it was pretty straightforward and smooth.
I am extremely fortunate, and I do not want to make everyone think that that's how this goes. Because I've had other fundraising experiences that were not that simple. I was just really fortunate that I found three people that believed in me and had also experienced the pain of trying to hire qualified people.
Sure.
They're all full-time investors, so they have a portfolio of companies, and every single portfolio company is having this problem.
So they
could see it day in and day out, and they saw, like, it's a real issue.
Yeah.
And so they saw that the product worked. They had portfolio companies that tested it, and those companies came back and said, yeah, we'd like to be a customer. So I think that helped with it too. But I am very fortunate, and I would say that having good angels that are supportive can make your entire life as a founder 1,000% easier, because you actually have relevant advice being given to you.
Yeah. And these are, were they all execs at companies before, or are they?
Some of the biggest corporations, one of them had been in the White House. I mean, they're the real deal. One's, I think, built three or four companies herself. Actually, this is a really cool factor, too. Two of them are women. And there's not enough investors, I think, that are women. That's one thing I look forward to one day, you know, maybe in a decade, is me actually being able to support more female founders. Because there is a challenge that we have that's a little bit different sometimes.
Spend a minute on that. Do you feel like, I mean, obviously you raise money, that's good, and you raise money from women, that's even better. Do you feel like being a woman founder, raising, held you back? Did you encounter any explicit, implicit bias? I don't know.
Yeah, I think there is some of it. I think ultimately an investor wants to invest in something that they get a return on their money, right? So then they're calculating the risk. Like, so what is this person about, and are they able to do this? I think there may be less female founders, like less entrepreneurs. But I think there's some really great entrepreneurs that get overlooked. And more when we start having, I'll give an example of the founder for Third Love, which is a bra company that's here in the Bay Area, and it's an AI tool online. They figure out what bra and they ship it to you. And they're great. Yeah, it's a great
AI
technology.
For bras.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's great. So Third Love, one of their founders is female. And so when you have that kind of success and it's, you know, and it's talked about a lot, I think it gives more traction to say, okay, let's invest in women. But I think as women, we need to be more aggressive sometimes. We need to realize that we've got to chase what we want and not just say, okay, there's some opposition, I won't go around it. Because that's just part of being a founder.
That's good. Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't explicitly sought out for this show to interview women or not women. But we've had quite a few. The last two or three of the last four have all been female founders, and it's just, and, you know, they're all rock stars, so I don't know. It's cool to see see it happening.
And I think we also, as women, we need to help each other more. There was, we're kind of, I don't know, historically we haven't always been great at that, and I try to make an active effort to help people that are, you know, maybe younger and haven't had some business experience up now.
Yeah, cool. All right, great. So this, and when did you guys close this round? This is recent or this is earlier?
See, that would be May, June timeframe. So we just closed, and we're raising $1.5 million now with the view to raise an A round probably second quarter of 2019.
And what are you thinking? Will you stay in Texas like for your investors?
What
kind
a
of loaded
great question. It is. That's a great question. So this was a, it took about 90 days to reflect on this because we had a lot of offers brought to us. That part of the deal was move to Boston, move to LA, move to San Francisco, whatever. And I've made the decision that we're not going to. We're going to stay in Austin. I travel all the time anyway to meet with customers, so I can be anywhere I need to be. But our team is distributed. We've got people that are in LA. We've got people in Colorado, San Francisco. That's part of being a tech company is being able to work like that. And we work very effectively in that way. But the big part is Austin's a great ecosystem. And the cost of living is more affordable. I wouldn't say it's great, but it's more affordable than San Francisco or LA. And the people that I'm talking to bring onto my team, they want to be able to afford a nice house. And they want to be able to have a short commute. And they can't do that in San Francisco right now.
Nice house in Austin without the commute. I'm thinking my brother-in-law who lives there up in Round Rock, and it's a great house. Got it for a steal, but it's a long commute.
It is a long commute. Well, so this depends on the flexibility of your employer, right?
Sure.
So
we
allow people to commute on off hours so they're not sitting in traffic. I don't want them sitting in traffic. They're stressed out. They're not happy. And then we also don't require that they come into the office every single day either. So there's ways around it, but we're really the capital that we bring into the business is going to be used much more effectively because we don't have a bad burn. And I just think it gets to be too expensive in some of these areas.
There was a panel here at TechCrunch Disrupt yesterday. I think it was Nicole Quinn, a VC, was saying when they invest in companies, she'll say, go to SFO on a map, draw like a radius of 3-hour flights around that, and then open your office and find a town that has, I'm paraphrasing here, find a town that has a university within a 3-hour flight and go open an office there because it's just too expensive here. And you're competing for engineers with Facebook and everyone else. Now, So Austin's, you know, certainly attractive from that perspective, and it's a great town. I love that town. Do you feel like the investors are more like valuation sensitive there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much so. Yeah.
Uh huh.
Yeah, and I don't know why that is. I think it's changing. I also think that a lot of the investors that used to absolutely require that you move to San Francisco or LA or Boston or wherever, they're relaxing that.
Yeah.
And the direct flights out of Austin have helped that. You know,
sure.
Because I can get to anywhere in the U.S. in about 3 hours.
Yeah.
And it's easy. Most of them don't even have to change the plane.
Yeah. They used to call it the nerd bird, right? The nerd bird?
I think it's still called that?
Yeah.
Yes. Every time I get on the plane between Austin and San Francisco, I see people I know.
Yeah.
We just kind of wave at each
right.
other. Yeah.
Good stuff. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're starting to raise again. Well, so are you, did you answer this question? Are you talking to investors here, there, everywhere?
Yeah. So, So this is if an investor is listening to this. I'm going to, just a word of advice.
Yep.
I get 50 emails a week from investors.
Do you?
Yeah.
From real investors or from their associates kind of fishing?
That's the point that I wanted to make is that if it, and this is not because I'm trying to be rude. It's because there's nothing more valuable than your time.
Sure.
And I don't have time for that. Right now I'm trying to build a business. So if an associate reaches out to me, I have a message I just send to them and say, once your firm gets serious about us, then feel free to reach back out. And that's just it. I don't even do it anymore. And I've been fortunate in the fact that at least, I'll say 5 to 10 a week are not associates. They're actually senior partners in the firm.
Okay.
And they're reaching out and they're asking me the right questions. And I'm like, okay, I'm not being farmed. I'm actually, you know. And that's the point we're at.
And so what do you do with that inbound interest?
Set up a call.
Yeah.
I usually like to show them a demo because there's a lot of people saying that they do AI stuff that they're not really doing that. And I just want to get that off the table and say, you know, we actually have real technology.
Yep.
So show them the demo. And then this is actually one of the things I've learned is I have a process.
Yeah.
And I don't fold into their process. This is my process.
Sure.
These are the lines. You know, this is how we're going to run it.
Yep.
And if they just can't work with that, then that's a good thing for me to know. Because if they truly value the fact that I'm trying to build a business, they understand why I have to work a process.
Yeah. So talk about your process. Touch on that just from high level, because I think that's interesting. I like that.
Yeah. So part of it is dates. Part of it is understanding what they have dry powder. You know, how is their fund new or is it closing out?
Yep.
What, you know, are they going to want to provide operational support or are they just going to be funding? Because that the due diligence is different. And then also, too, I don't actually give them access to our to a Dropbox where they can just go and surf through our information. I don't do that. I'll sit down with them. I'll fly out to wherever they are, sit down with them and go through due diligence. But we have a lot of things that I don't want shared digitally right now. And some of the things can't be patent because they're algorithms. We're not going to share those. And some things we have patents in the process and we can't disclose that.
Gotcha. Okay, great. All right. Other things that you've learned along the way or things you would do differently if you were starting this all over again?
So I think this has been said a long time. I think Jack Welch of GE actually was the first person that said this, which is fire fast and hire slow. That is so true. Just so completely true. And I can take a person who's in great alignment with me that sees the vision, that understands the passion that I have around it. And if they're in alignment with that, we can generally make things work as long as they have the basic skill set that we need.
Yep.
But someone that's out of alignment with where we're headed, it just, and it can be on small things. And you think maybe, oh, their talent's worth bringing them in. And I would just say it's not.
Yeah.
They just have to be in alignment with that. Also, I think you've got to be in alignment on work ethic. So whatever the founder thinks the work ethic is, that if you're something different than that, it's just too much of a push and pull. So I focus on a very small team of really exceptionally qualified people that are also in alignment with me. And fortunately, I have a very good tool. That's the one that we developed that I can find basically anyone I want to find.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So I have that advantage. Right. And for that point, we work with startups a lot to try to help them because I want them to be able to achieve the same thing we have.
Mm-hmm.
I would say TED Talk training. I needed to be a better speaker.
Uh-huh.
I needed to be more comfortable. I've had to speak to rooms that are thousands of people, and I hadn't planned on doing that when I just wanted to build something, solve a problem. Business of Software Commerce.
So you went and got training by people who put on TED Talks? What does TED Talk training mean
so
exactly?
So there's actually trainers that train people for TED Talks.
Okay, gotcha.
And I went through that training. And so there's a thing called imposter syndrome that I didn't know I had, but I did. And it affects a lot of people. And I'm an introvert, and I needed to kind of understand everything that brings to the table when you're trying to do a big talk.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to do talks everywhere between 1 minute and 45 minutes. And you never know when you're going to be presented the opportunity, and you just have to be ready.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Cool. TED Talk training, what else?
Business of Software is a conference that really should be called Business of Technology, but I found out about it. They gave me a sponsorship out of Cambridge. And Business of Software happens in England and also happens in the U.S. every year. We're going to it in a couple of weeks. And they shut the doors, and there's founders that just lay it all out. And the information is never shared. It's not going to be on Twitter or anything else.
Yeah.
And it saved me from so many disasters.
Interesting.
And they just truly bare their soul.
It's called Business of Software?
Yeah, BOS.
BOS, okay.
Yeah, Mark Littlewood is kind of the person that created it. And it's a fantastic group of people. It's an ecosystem, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not gone to it last year, and I can actually feel like I haven't gone to it, right? So I'm going to go in a couple of weeks. I'm looking forward to it.
Cool.
And then I'd say circle yourself around good advisors.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of bad advice in the world, and that's actually why I really love what Founder Suite does.
Thank you.
When I was looking through...
Not a paid endorsement.
No, it's not. It's not a paid endorsement. But when I was looking through, like... real information, a lot of founders want to like structure some story that's looks cleaner than it really is. It's messy.
Sure.
And so I think advisors that have built companies, if you'll just listen to them, you'll start hearing the trends over and over, and you're like, okay, I really need to not do that, and so sometimes it's painful to listen to them because it's contrary to what you think you should be doing. I think that's huge. I think as far as building strategic partnerships, there were times where we went to you would think it was a competitor of ours.
Yeah.
And we went to them and we're like, look, you and I are both trying to battle together against some of the biggest companies in the world in a market that is $470 trillion a year.
Yeah.
Billion. $470 billion a year. And we will possibly survive if we will work cooperatively together, and that is how we've gotten to where we've been. If we had not had that kind of mindset, we wouldn't make it, I don't think.
It's funny, here at Disrupt yesterday, the first day, there's a booth in Fintech Alley, and I walked by like five times. I kept walking by, and they're same exact thing, won't need the name, but it's a company that's could be a great partner for Founder Suite, or we might be kind of competitive.
Right.
I mean? And I just kept walking by, and finally I stopped in and chatted and got the demo. But it's kind of funny, you have to sort of overcome that fear or something, whatever it is.
Well, we're competitive.
We're competitive.
If you're
right.
an entrepreneur, you're competitive.
Sure.
I don't, and it's just baked into you. But what I look at it is like, wait, I'm competitive, but my competition is not another little guy.
Yeah.
It's the big guys.
Sure.
And so how are you going to actually win market? And when you combine, and if you just think, what does the customer want? The customer wants us to work together. The customer does not want to have to pick between us because we do things a little bit different.
Uh-huh.
And it's been incredible. It's been very good for our customers.
Yeah. Awesome. Great. Anything else we haven't covered, or have we covered?
One last one is be incubated. And the reason why is because you sit next to founders that are going through the pain every day.
Yeah.
And you need the moral support of people that have walked in your shoes and are walking in your shoes currently.
Yeah.
And you will also get much better deals and much better investors coming to you if you're inside an incubator, because I think they know that.
Interesting. Are you in one in Austin, or this is back in the Cambridge days?
We were at Idea Space at University of Cambridge. Uh-huh. I still actually have office space there. But no, we are not an incubator. We're real office now.
Real office, yeah. Awesome. Very good. Well, great. So if people want to learn more, is it thiswayglobal.com?
Yeah, thiswayglobal.com. Or also you can go to aiforjobs.com.
Either way, F-O-R or the number four?
The number four. Yeah, uh-huh. The number four. And we will get back to you. And we have all kinds of deals that we work with VCs and their portfolio companies, mm-hmm. and then also startups. You just kind of need to tell us that you're one of those guys, and we'll make a special deal for you, because primarily we're an enterprise B2B company.
Okay, great. All right, Angela, this is fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good luck
for
the rest of the event.
Awesome.
Cheers.
All right, appreciate it.
Okay.